This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The movie Moonlight, which won the Oscar for Best Picture in 2017, was adapted from a script by my guest Terrell Alvin McCraney. He and the film's director, Barry Jenkins, won an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. McCraney is now the creator of the series David Makes Man, where he's also an executive producer and writer. It's in its second season on OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network. Like Moonlight, it begins with a boy growing up in the projects in a Miami neighborhood who's neglected by his crack-addicted mother, which echoes McCraney's childhood. But in David Makes Man, the mother is able to get clean and stay sober. David is very smart and is one of two black students in the gifted and talented class at his magnet school. He manages to get into prep school, where he's again one of the few black students, and he's surrounded by students from families with money. The code switching required going back and forth from the projects to school is confusing and complicated. In season two, we fast forward to David as an adult. He's become a successful businessman and is doing the marketing for a developer with political aspirations who's trying to revitalize the neighborhood where David grew up. But some people see David as just the black face for a development company trying to get zoning permission to tear down the projects, build a shopping mall, and gentrify the neighborhood with no concerns about displacing the people who live there. Meanwhile, David is still haunted by the shame and trauma of his childhood. Terrell Alvin McCraney is a graduate of what is now called the David Geffen School of Drama at Yale, where he now chairs the playwriting program. When he was a student at the Yale School of Drama, he became August Wilson's assistant. In 2013, McCraney won a MacArthur Fellowship, a.k.a. the Genius Award. Terrell Alvin McCraney, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back on our show. The last time we spoke, Moonlight had just been released, and the film since won 3 Oscars, including yours for Best Adapted Screenplay. How has your life changed since then?
First of all, thanks for having me back. And it was lovely speaking to you then. And I've since become a fan. So thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
You know, it's really interesting. After the Academy Awards, you know, a lot of opportunities sort of showed up at my doorstep. And I kind of, you know, didn't take a lot of them.
Why not?
To this moment, I don't fully know. I do know some of it had to do with just growing up waiting for the other shoe to drop, growing up anticipating, you know, the bear around the corner, as some specialists will say. You know, you grow up with a lot of trauma, you grow up with a lot of disappointment and not feeling protected. You kind of think, oh, well, when this good thing happens, it's only in, you know, it's in service of this really bad thing that's about to come. And so I wasn't really spending a lot of time feeling great about the accomplishment. My best friend, you know, was with me the night at the Academy Awards, and we get to the, you know, the governor's ball and the Vanity Fair party, and I must have been there for 15 to 20 minutes before I just was like, I gotta go home. And I left. I left the Vanity Fair party with all these, you know, amazing things happening and stories to tell, but I couldn't, there was just nothing. I wasn't feeling excited. I was feeling scared and nervous and out of place, and yeah.
This reminds me so much of David and David Makes Man, in the sense that, I mean, he's very different from you, but he, like you, seems haunted by the trauma of the past and is having like difficulty getting past that. You know, David's mother was crack addicted. She gets sober in the series and is really a kind of changed person. But for you, like, your mother never made it to that. And she died of complications from AIDS. And how old were you when she died?
22. There's actually two differences. I mean, you know, my mother had a crack addiction, but also suffered from severe depression and undiagnosed, and was rarely offered any access or resources to that. And I think David isn't addicted to a substance, but has a kind of addiction to this chaos, because that's all he knows. And so when he's triggered, right, he goes into this kind of fugue state where he's just really, he uses all of his passion, all of his imagination to make these really big, dangerous decisions. And that was really important to me because I do that more than I've not been, you know, I don't think I have a substance abuse. I don't really drink, but I sometimes will throw myself into these really scary situations and powerfully chaotic situations in order to make my life feel like it's normal.
Wait, can I stop you there?
Sure.
Can you give us an example of what you're talking about?
Yeah, like all of a sudden I need to run a playwriting program and write, you know, a television show. And, you know, for example, I remember one time I was flying back and forth from Miami to New York to LA, you know, every 2 days in order to work. And that might sound great, right? People are like, oh, that's amazing. That's an amazing life to lead. But I was getting sick all the time. My anxiety was really high. I wasn't eating very well. I wasn't taking care of myself. I was just throwing myself at the work. And so in a capitalist society, we think, oh, that's normal. That's what you do. Until you realize that I'm not enjoying anything. People are like, well, what do you do for fun? I'm like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? Like, why are you skipping out on the Vanity Fair party with Halle Berry? And like, you know, there are people there that I've just loved in my entire life. And then you compound that with like, just, you know, not just, but American racism. So I've got to deal with the microaggressions and the sort of surveillance society we live in constantly, while I'm also combating my own frustrations about not being, you know, this flight's delayed. So now I'm frustrated and I can't act frustrated because if I act frustrated, I'm probably going to get shot 5 times in the back, right? Or put on the no-fly list. So I got to be calm about that. And so I'm stuffing down all of who I am, not enjoying anything, not sustaining relationships, not contacting friends, not anything, in order to do these amazing things that make me feel like my life is normal.
Was it also about giving you a sense of like a positive identity? Like, I've achieved this. I'm not just my past. I'm not just like the trauma-stricken child. I have these achievements. I have these awards.
Yes and no. I mean, I think the part that's absolutely right that I will underline is it gives me a sense of worth, right? Because often I was told that I'm not worth much, right? I'm black, I'm queer, I'm in this world, my body has been attacked, my person has been attacked. All the things that come natural to me, the way I walk, the way I speak, have been told that they were worthless or less than. And that comes from, you know, societal femophobia, anti-blackness, you name it, right? And so because I was told that for so long, I have to do these things that are beautiful. I have to make these things that are amazing. I have to make these things that are compelling and touching and, you know, and the awards are great and good, but you know, you start to learn that those are never enough, right? People telling you that you're great and good, they're never enough. You still keep chasing. I got to make another thing. I got to make something more beautiful, more touching, more human. There was a time that I started with a therapist and she was like, look, I can't technically make you do anything, but if you keep doing this, I do have the ability to write to your employers and say like, hey, I don't think this person should be working right now. And I just think you should know that. And I was like, oh yeah, if she's willing to go that far, I need to take stock because I'm clearly not looking at how ragged I'm running myself.
David, in your series, and the main character, Chiron, in Moonlight, they were exposed to violence growing up in the projects. And it sounds like violence is something you were exposed to, too. There was a person in your life, kind of like in Moonlight, who was both a drug dealer and your mother's boyfriend and a kind of father figure to you who was shot and killed. This might be too personal to ask, but in addition to witnessing violence, were you the victim of it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean that's not personal. It's in everything. I mean, in Moonlight, it's so funny because I remember Barry called me a couple times or wrote to me or maybe texted me a couple times asking me about certain scenes you know, certain moments and going, wait, did this really happen? Or do you remember writing this? Or, and most of the time I would say, no, I don't remember writing it. I remember feeling it. I remember going through it. I remember when it happened. And oftentimes folks, you know, talk about the film or even the television show and will think about the fantastic parts and go, or the parts that they feel are the most naturalistic and think, oh, well, this really happened and that didn't. And I have to correct them sometimes, like the thing that they don't, that feels so amazing that couldn't possibly have happened, that actually happened. So like for what? Example,
yeah.
Well, because everyone's like, well, did Kevin really, befriend you one day and then walk into the spill out area and, you know, play a game called knock down, stay down, where he punched you over and over again and asked you to stay down. I was like, yeah, absolutely. That happened.
This was in Moonlight.
Yeah, that absolutely happened. That's true. Like kid, as far as I know, kids still play that game. Right. And yeah, he even apologized and even said to state, he's like, state, look, just stay down. If I hit you, just stay down and then they'll stop. Right. And to me that was really, it was a betrayal. Cause I was like, well, why must I like allow myself to be humiliated and harmed in this way in order for, you know, you all to have a great time or feel better about yourself? Like what about that is necessary for me?
It must have been a very confusing world to grow up in, code switching between living in the projects and going to a magnet school and going to a prep school. And like in David Makes Man, what you need to do to get respect in the projects is if somebody pushes you, you'd better either push back or punch him, because otherwise you're going to lose respect. But in school, if somebody pushes you and you push back or punch him, you're going to get suspended. That's like not acceptable behavior. And that did you go through that kind of confusion growing up, like having to completely change the rules depending on where you were in order to succeed or to just like get enough respect so that you can survive?
I don't know if it was confusing as much as it was exhausting. I say that, and I really mean that, and it's still exhausting. The social kind of interactions of all, I mean, everybody code switches in some ways. And I think, and even going to, you know, even going from living in Homestead, which is, you know, outside of Miami, and living in Liberty City, and then going to school in the suburbs, and then going to magnet school or going to school in the inner city, like every single place had its own, you know, code of conduct or its rules, right, for respect and respectability. Even now, there's a respectability politic that, you know, sometimes, you know, when people are like, well, when you deal with the cops, you should deal with them in this way, or don't stand up for your rights, or you should stand up for your rights, or say, like, it's so exhausting, the amount of like, you should do X in order to, you know, survive. But it becomes such a part of you. It becomes such a habit, this switching to survive, that you don't remember to turn it off. And you start doing it everywhere. You start doing it at the doctor's office. You start doing it with your intimate partners. And at some point you forget to just be. You forget to allow your most intimate self to come forward because you're trying to figure out how to survive a moment that isn't about life or death.
You know, you mentioned earlier that your mother suffered from undiagnosed depression. How old were you when you realized that? And did it help you understand and forgive her, knowing that she had an untreated mental health issue?
I had to be 13, and the therapist at the magnet school that I was at Mays Middle in Goulds, said, you know, I think you might be depressed. And I said, oh, maybe. And then they started telling me, I will never forget, Dr. Sands, Mrs. Sands said, I think you might be depressed. Here's some things that you're doing that, you know, that happens when we're depressed or sad. What's going on at home? And I thought, oh, no, my mom is just like that. I can't be depressed. My mom is exactly like this. Withdrawn sometimes really forward, sometimes really out outwardly affectionate, and then sometimes just, you know, inconsolable, moody, sad, distant. And so I realized, I was like, well, we both have it, whatever it is. And it just became easier. I remember, and it also happened that that year she was 31 and I was 13. And I just thought that was really cool. So I just felt like it just made it easier for me to always identify like, oh no, we are connected in this way. And forgive her. It wasn't even a matter of forgive her. I understood her. And at that point it just became easier to just be there and be a part of it. Now there were things that were still hurtful, of course. But it just made it simpler for me to, there was no gulf between where I couldn't recognize who she was.
Did you talk with her about that and say, look, I think you're suffering from depression. You should get help for that. What was her reaction?
There were two things. One, she was very receptive to saying, you know, sometimes I don't feel great. But then the other part was, well, I'm not an addict, so this doesn't matter. Right. And so she was in that part of denial that she couldn't quite, you know, come to terms with at that moment. I mean, later she did go into rehab a few times. But at that moment, she just, you know, there was a 13-year-old diagnosing her with depression and telling her that she was a drug addict.
Did you have to keep things like that a secret, if not in the projects, when you were in school?
Well, I didn't. And there are parts of me that wished that I had, because we almost ended up in the foster system because of it. And we were, you know, when people started realizing that, because people would say, well, why don't you ever have like clean clothes? You wear like the same thing every day. And I would go, well, we can't go to the washing machine. We can't use the washing machine. We don't have any money. The lights are off, or we don't, you know, can I call your mother? The phone's off. Well, what did you eat today? Well, we don't have a lot of food. So I ate when I got to school today. And so I wish more so that I had some ability to, and again, this is wishful thinking in hindsight. So it doesn't, it's like magic thinking. I wish I had some ability to take better care of us at the time, but I didn't. Because once the school did find out, once the projects did find out, they took us away from our mother. And some of that was great because again, she went to rehab and had to focus on herself. But when we were taken away, there were four of us and we almost ended up in the foster care, system. And, you know, that could have been worse. I thank God that we had some family members step up and take care of us at that time.
Did you move in with them or did they move in with you?
No, we moved in with them. So my younger brother and sister moved in with my aunt, and my brother and I moved in with my dad and my grandparents.
Did you become close with your father?
I wouldn't say close. We are closer now, but at that time, not really. Because again, you had this kid who was, again, 13, 14, used to surviving on their own, now being asked to follow new rules. And I did what I do all the time, which is I just go, oh, what do I have to do to maintain peace in this place? Great, I'll do that. And then I'll still do what I want to do when I go to school. For instance, I signed myself up for the magnet school that I went, the performance art school that I went to, unbeknownst to him.
Was there any less code switching that you had to do in the performing arts school because you were dealing with people aspiring to be artists? And a lot of artists feel like they're different from other people. And I don't mean that like I'm better than, but just like they're on their own wavelength and they understand other people who are on their own wavelength. And a lot of artists suffer from depression and understand what that is intuitively, even if they don't have the language.
Oh, well, it took me, no, there was still code switching. I was in school with, you know, with students who lived on Star Island. So that there was still.
Is that a wealthy community?
Yes, sorry. Star Island is where Puff Daddy lives.
Oh, okay.
And Will Smith.
Say
and,
no more. Yeah.
And so it was not Liberty City. And so I was being bussed into, you know, I was taking the train from Liberty City to the school that was small and intimate, but also filled with students who had been practicing their art all their lives, but with tutors and had drivers show up at school to take them home. And I still, you know, would have to take a jitney or a bus home.
Did you have the kind of pressure that your character does of thinking like only one black person is going to be allowed to succeed here and it's got to be me?
Yes, not at my art school, but in undergrad for sure, and even in grad school. The more the elite, the institution, the more that's true. There only graduated two black men in my acting class in undergrad, and we started as a class of 50. We graduated a class of 20, and there were two black men. I was one of them. And in the playwriting program at Yale, I was the only black person out of 9 playwrights.
That certainly increases the pressure, right?
Well, it just increases a whole bunch of things. It increases the ability to feel like you're in it for the actual art, right? Or rather, are you there to represent who you are as a person? I mean, there's a reason why I was August Wilson's assistant, because there was no other black playwright in the program at the time.
Well, this has just been so good to talk with you. I really appreciate it so much, and I wish you good health, and I wish you all good things.
Oh, same to you and yours. Thank you so much again. I appreciate the invitation.
Terrell Alvin McCraney won an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for the film Moonlight. He's the creator of the TV series David Makes Man, which is now in its second season on OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network. One of the most awaited literary debuts of the year has just been published, but its 28-year-old author, Anthony Viesnaso, died unexpectedly last December. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, says, "These 9 stories, mostly about first-generation Cambodian Americans navigating differences with their parents' generation of education, sexuality, and possibility, are a bittersweet triumph."
It's impossible to talk about After Parties, the much-heralded short story collection by Anthony Viesnaso, without first talking about its backstory. So died this past December of a drug overdose. He was only 28. Most readers who pick up this collection will already know about So's death. And yet, I'm guessing that, like me, a fair number of those readers will be in denial as they're reading these short stories. His voice is so alive, smart, flip, funny, rude, sexually explicit, and compassionate. Come on, it doesn't make sense that upon its introduction to the larger literary world, such a fresh voice has already been stilled. That freshness is derived not only from So's style as a writer, but from the nuanced perspective of his ultra-intersectional identity. So was a queer, first-generation Cambodian-American who graduated from Stanford and the MFA program at Syracuse University. He grew up in Stockton, California, where his working-class parents, along with many other Cambodian refugees, settled after fleeing the genocidal regime of the Khmer Rouge. Almost all of the 9 stories in After Parties are set in Stockton, a place we're told that some U.S. government official deemed worthy of a bunch of PTSD'd-out refugees. That's the teenage narrator of a story called May Lee, May Lee, May Lee. He's a young gay man who can't wait to escape this landscape of Dollar Tree stores and cheap sushi joints. But Toby, the slightly older gay narrator of another story called The Shop, has a more wistful view. In fact, Toby has gone home to Stockton after graduating college in the Midwest to work at his father's auto shop. There, most of the men are, like his father, survivors of the killing fields. Here's Toby's view of the place. "Truth be told, I could have lived like this forever. Days at the shop, being lulled by the sounds of rusty machinery, deadbolts being bolted and unbolted, Dad and his guys making fun of American dieting for being less effective than the Khmer Rouge diet of boiled grass. All I needed was the occasional hookup." Throughout his collection, So dramatizes the push-pull of being first generation. His characters vacillate between a loyalty to the class and culture they grew up in and a yearning to ditch the weight of all that horrific Cambo history by moving away and maybe picking up a degree or two, as of course So himself did. His characters in the most memorable stories are one of a kind. In Three Women of Chuck's Donuts, a story evocative of Edward Hopper's Nighthawks, two young sisters work in their mother's 24-hour donut shop and speculate on the silent man who comes in every night and doesn't eat his apple fritter. In Super King's Son Scores Again, a badminton coach who works in his parents' crummy Super King grocery store is driven mad with jealousy of his star player. But to my mind, it's the story with the ironically vague title, Human Development, that hints at So's greater reach on the topic of identity that his future work might have achieved. Human Development is narrated by a character named Anthony, 3 years out of Stanford, and unlike his techie friends, making chump change. Anthony is teaching at a private high school in Marin on a 2-year contract as the Frank Chin Endowed Teaching Fellow for Diversity. When we meet him, he's rereading Moby Dick in preparation for teaching it. Here's a snippet of a beautiful passage where Anthony reflects on Moby Dick. "It was the first novel I'd ever read that didn't care for resolutions. It validated for me the experience of confusion, of exploring something as stupid and vast as a white whale, as an ocean. I wanted my students to understand the doomed nature of Ahab's hunt for Moby Dick, the profound calm of Ishmael's aimless wandering, the difference between having purpose like Ahab and finding meaning like Ishmael. I thought my students should learn the best ways to be lost." Anthony subsequently hooks up with an older man named Ben. Ben is yet another Bay Area techie, and he seems thrilled to be with Anthony, especially because the two of them are Cambodian American. Ben is working on an app that, as he proudly says, will allow people of color, people with disabilities, people identifying as LGBTQ, to cruise for safe spaces. Spaces not specifically for sex, but for the whole of their lives. What's at odds here are the attitudes towards identity of Anthony, who's not particularly wrapped up in being Cambodian American, but thinks of himself as more of a skeptical, free-floating intellectual like Ishmael, and Ben, who's like Ahab, fixating on the consummation of a clarifying goal. Here, So embraces uncertainty and undermines several potent markers of identity, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and the diversity industry itself. It's heartbreaking that we won't see So's continued exploration of these themes. Instead, like Anthony reading Moby Dick, we too must be satisfied to live without resolutions.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed After Parties by Anthony Vizna So. Coming up, we hear from journalist Peter Bergen. His new book, The Rise and Fall of Osama bin Laden, is based in part on materials seized in the raid in which bin Laden was killed. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Dave Davies has the next interview. Here's Dave.
When Navy SEALs shot Osama bin Laden in that 2011 raid in Pakistan, to confirm his identity, they compared his face to one in photos they were carrying, and they noticed a discrepancy. The Osama in the photos had a gray beard. The beard on the man before them was jet black. The reason? Bin Laden had been using Just for Men hair dye. That's one of the details you'll find in a new book about bin Laden by our guest, Peter Bergen. As we approach the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, Bergen is publishing a biography of the founder of Al-Qaeda. Bergen has spent much of his career reporting on Al-Qaeda and the global jihadist movement. In 1997, he traveled to Afghanistan for CNN to produce the first television interview of bin Laden. He's published 6 previous books, including several about Al-Qaeda, and he was the only journalist to get inside bin Laden's compound after the U.S. raid before it was demolished. His new book is based in part on material seized in the raid and on hundreds of interviews, including conversations with a dozen of bin Laden's inner circle. Bergen writes in the new book that he wanted to understand why bin Laden created an organization dedicated to the mass murder of civilians. Peter Bergen is still a national security analyst for CNN. He's also vice president for global studies and fellows at the think tank New America, and he's a professor at Arizona State University, where he co-directs the Center on the Future of War. His new book is The Rise and Fall of Osama bin Laden. Well, Peter Bergen, welcome back to Fresh Air. You've written so much about Osama bin Laden. What kind of new source material were you able to draw on this new research?
Well, key to all this was it was only in late 2017 that the Trump administration released the 470,000 files that were recovered in Abbottabad, Pakistan, included in which was something that was described by the CIA as bin Laden's journal. It turned out to be something slightly different. It's all handwritten in Arabic. It was the kind of a family journal that the bin Laden family kept essentially in the last several weeks of bin Laden's life. And it's a kind of good window into, you know, both what he was thinking at the time and also what his two older wives were thinking and his adult children, because they basically were kind of perplexed about what to do about the events of the Arab Spring, which bin Laden well understood as the most important event, you know, in the Middle East, arguably in centuries, was his own view of it. And yet, you know, his ideas, his followers were absent in at least the, you know, the first several months of the Arab Spring.
Right. You know, there's a lot of fascinating material here about those last months before the U.S. raid in Pakistan. At this compound where bin Laden was hiding, you know, he was, I guess, the most hunted man on earth at that point. And he had a lot of people living with him. How many? Who were they?
Well, the total was 27, 16 of his own family and 11. He had two bodyguards and their families. So, you know, typically when we think of a fugitive, we don't think of a fugitive taking three wives and a dozen kids and grandkids with them. But bin Laden, you know, one of the themes of the book is bin Laden, for all his many vices and you know, all the evil that he and death and destruction that he caused, he was something of a family man. And he wanted to have his family around him. And in fact, the folks at the CIA who were really tracking bin Laden knew him the best. You know, the fact that he, this mysterious group of people who were living in this compound, seemed to include many family members. You know, for them, that was a tell that it might well be bin Laden, because bin Laden had always had at least three or four wives with him at any given moment, despite the fact that, you know, even when he was living in exile in Sudan in the 90s and then in Afghanistan in the 5 years before 9/11, he was surrounded by family members despite the risks of, you know, even before 9/11, he was, you know, very much wanted by the United States. So he had this, you know, sort of significant entourage.
It's understating it to say he was security conscious. What kind of restrictions did he impose on all of these, you know, wives, grandchildren, the bodyguards, their families?
Well, interestingly, it was a prison of his own making, and he was the chief warden in a sense. And he himself, was extremely careful about what he did. He would walk around the garden with a cowboy hat on so that nobody could recognize him if there was a satellite overhead. He had a healthy respect for American spy capabilities. And, you know, his family members were not leaving the compound. He never left the compound. In fact, he was hiding to such a degree that one of the bodyguard's wives wasn't aware that it was Osama bin Laden living amongst them, even though she herself was living on the same compound. And one time bin Laden appeared on TV, and one of the daughters, 9-year-old daughters of the bodyguard, asked, you know, kind of, isn't that the guy who's living here? And at that point, the bodyguard kind of got rid of the TV and told his daughter, you know, not to talk about this, and also, you know, prevented contact with the bin Laden family. So bin Laden was hiding from people on his own compound.
These two guys that were working there, you know, are sometimes described as bodyguards. They were really much more than that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, bin Laden didn't treat them particularly well. One of the interesting things that comes out of these documents is how angry they were about basically they were being paid $100 a month in local currency. Bin Laden had always been something of a miser. And, you know, they were taking these enormous risks looking after the world's most wanted man and his family members. And they were very concerned. They were concerned that they would be found. They were telling bin Laden he couldn't bring additional family members into the compound. His third wife, who'd been living under house arrest in Iran, showed up, and the bodyguards said they wouldn't go and pick her up and bring her into the compound. In the end, she appeared at the compound against sort of the better judgment of the bodyguards. And bin Laden was at one point actually wrote a formal letter to the bodyguards on January 15th, 2011, a few months before he was killed, saying, you know, I understand that our disagreements have become so profound that even though you live on the same compound, I'm writing you this formal letter to kind of acknowledge what we've agreed, which is, let me find new protectors. And of course, bin Laden would also have to leave this compound that he'd so carefully planned with its 18-foot walls in places to go somewhere else, because the compound itself was registered in one of the bodyguards' names. So his relations with the two people who are really keeping al-Qaeda and him afloat were really beginning to fray in the last several months of his life.
Yeah, you would think someone who you relied so in so many ways on to keep you safe, you might pay a little better and treat a little better. I mean, the compound was registered in their names, right? They burned their own trash there, right? They grew a lot of their own food. Did anybody ever leave? Did the kids go to school?
The kids were homeschooled. You know, one of the kind of interesting things about the book is the extent to which bin Laden's two older wives played such an important role in his life, because two of them had PhDs, which I think might be surprising to some listeners who may sort of assume that bin Laden was not going to marry kind of highly educated women. One had a PhD in child psychology, another one had a PhD in Quranic grammar. And so these two older wives were homeschooling the kids, and they'd been doing this for years, even before 9/11. And these wives were also playing an important part in kind of helping bin Laden think through complicated strategic problems that related to kind of the future direction of al-Qaeda.
There was no internet access there, is that right? I mean, could people watch television, listen to the radio?
They could watch Al Jazeera on satellite TV, and bin Laden watched a lot of Al Jazeera because, of course, he was kind of a news junkie. When a female announcer came on screen, he would kind of get his remote and flip a kind of the screen guide so it covered her face. They took the whole kind of concept of separation of men and women so much to heart that when men came on the TV, the women would leave the room. But yeah, they would certainly watch some television. And in fact, amongst many of the 470,000 files I mentioned that were released at the end of 2017 by the Trump administration, there was quite a number of cartoons that the kids were watching. So they watched TV, but it was kind of limited to news and cartoons.
So how did he manage relationships with all these wives in this place? Did they have their own living space? Did he spend time in bedrooms alternating ways with each of them?
You know, I mean, the night he was killed, it was Amal's, quote, turn with a shake.
Amal was the youngest wife, right?
Amal was the youngest wife. And so the night he was killed, it was Amal's turn with a shake. The way they referred to bin Laden was a shake, an honorific title. And so, yeah, they clearly had turns with bin Laden. He viewed his wives as, you know, if you can treat them all equitably, you're allowed to have the four wives that the Quran sanctions. And so bin Laden would, in each house he was in, he would create spaces for each of his wives. They would each have their own bedroom. They would each have their own kind of rudimentary kitchen. When I visited the Abbottabad compound before it was demolished in 2012, you know, I could see that each wife had her own little, she had her bedroom, her bathroom, and then her own kind of crude kitchen. They were not living in any great luxury, but bin Laden certainly was trying to treat each of his wives equitably.
Right. And there's this little detail of him using Just for Men hair dye on his beard. Do we know why?
You know, vanity, I think. You know, he also would use, you know, when he did his videos, he would often apply, he wanted to look younger. I mean, the guy was, when bin Laden died, he was 54, but he certainly looked a lot older in reality. So, you know, he was using Just for Men hair dye. When I visited the compound, I was in his bedroom, the bedroom in which he was killed, and I saw, you know, in his toilet area, Just for Men hair dye. And, you know, he was vain. I mean, he was very kind of conscious of his media appearances. He would, you know, sometimes get people to redo takes, and he would often, you can, in the videos that were released by the Trump administration in December 2017 that came out of the compound, you know, he would do multiple takes of his speeches. He was very interested in micromanaging kind of the way that he appeared in the media. So I think that the fact he was dyeing his hair, dyeing his beard, you know, isn't that surprising.
You know, the months before Osama bin Laden's death in 2011 was the beginning of the Arab Spring. I mean, this outburst of democratic aspiration and activity. How did bin Laden regard these developments?
With a great excitement. He wrote one of his top deputies, "This is probably the most important development in the Middle East in centuries." But he was also perplexed about what to do about these great events because he was cognizant of the fact that the protesters in the streets of Cairo or in the streets of Tunisia were not waving banners of bin Laden demanding, you know, Taliban-style theocracies. They were demanding universal human rights, the rights to assembly, free speech, not to live under an authoritarian, corrupt government. So, you know, bin Laden really was thinking through about how do I respond to this? Well, how can I position myself to be relevant? What can I say about it? And in fact, you know, the Arab Spring, by the time bin Laden, starts really, you know, in January of 2011, he's killed in May of 2011. You know, I think the fact that he never really was able to produce a statement addressing the events of the Arab Spring during his lifetime kind of speaks for itself, because he just didn't quite know what to say, how to position himself as leader of the Arab Spring. There was, 2 weeks after he died, posthumously, Al-Qaeda released a tape in which he did talk about the events of the Arab Spring, and he made some very sort of general comments about, you know, these great events, and, you know, he wanted to play a role. But it's not like he could contribute very, you know, great ideas to these events, because the protesters were not demanding kind of what Al-Qaeda was offering, which is essentially, you know, bin Laden's vision of the future was Taliban-style theocracies from Indonesia to Morocco. And the protesters in the Arab Spring, that was not what they were interested in.
Yeah, it must have been so frustrating to him, to a man who had had such impact 10 years earlier, to kind of be a bystander to history.
I think it was frustrating. When you look at this, so there's the 228-page bin Laden family journal. They began writing the journal several weeks before bin Laden died. And basically every night they would gather before dinner and sometimes after dinner as well and sort of discuss the events of the day. You know, they talked about the revolutions in Tunisia, the revolution in Egypt, the uprisings against Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And, you know, bin Laden was, you know, watching a lot of Al Jazeera and listening to a lot of and watching a lot of BBC and kind of absorbing a lot of the news. And he would then sort of have meetings with his two oldest wives and his two oldest daughters and oldest son. And they would talk through kind of what had happened that day. But they were preparing a speech that bin Laden would give. And, you know, they were very excited about this speech because they thought that bin Laden could, you know, it was kind of a crazy idea, but they thought that once bin Laden delivered this speech, that somehow he would become one of the leaders of the Arab Spring. And bin Laden's big idea was that, you know, he would kind of suggest that a council of kind of religious elders would kind of be convened to advise the new governments in the Arab world. Of course, there was no demand for this idea, but this was the idea that he alighted upon. He was also considering issuing some kind of mea culpa to the Muslim world about, he was very cognizant of the fact that Al-Qaeda and its affiliates had killed many Muslim civilians, whether Al-Qaeda in Iraq or Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And he felt that this was damaging Al-Qaeda's kind of brand in the Muslim world. And so he was also contemplating issuing some kind of public apologia, saying, you know, basically we're a group that is committed not to killing Muslims. And he never delivered that message, but it was certainly something that he was very interested in delivering in the context of the Arab Spring and also in the upcoming 10th anniversary of 9/11, because bin Laden was also very cognizant that that was coming up very soon and that it was a good moment to reposition Al-Qaeda, this kind of kinder and gentler Al-Qaeda that he was hoping to create.
It's interesting that they'd spent so long in this place that was very isolated, and I wonder if it could sort of breed a kind of delusion that this guy who nobody really wanted to hear from anymore very much was the man of the hour and whose words, you know, could move history.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these were delusions. And, I mean, bin Laden was deluded about a lot of things. First of all, he was deluded about the American reaction to 9/11. He had no idea that the United States was really going to go into Afghanistan, topple the Taliban, and there was kind of an ex post facto kind of gloss he put on what happened, sort of saying this was all a clever diabolical plan to bring the United States into the Middle East and kind of bankrupt the United States. But really, that was not his plan at all. He thought 9/11 would push the United States out of the Middle East. And then all the client regimes of the United States, such as the Saudis regime, would fall. So, I mean, he had a bunch of delusions. They started with kind of what the American reaction would be to 9/11. And they continued with, when he was on the run, about basically he believed that, Al-Qaeda would be able to mount another attack on the United States. He was very hopeful about this. And, he seemed not to understand that Al-Qaeda had basically been largely decimated in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. I quote one of his longtime associates in the book who says that of the 1,900 Arab fighters who were living in Afghanistan at the time of 9/11, 1,600 of them were killed or captured in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. And there was other people in Al-Qaeda who understood that the 9/11 attacks had been sort of a kamikaze mission for Al-Qaeda. And bin Laden was telling them, you need to kill President Barack Obama or kill General David Petraeus, or don't bother with them, Vice President Joe Biden, because he's not prepared to be president. But he was sort of inciting them to do these attacks. And, who was going to do that? And I quote James Clapper, who was the director of national intelligence at the time of bin Laden's death, who said, it reminded him a little bit of Hitler, moving around these divisions at the end of World War II that didn't exist.
Peter Bergen, thank you so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you.
Peter Bergen is a national security analyst for CNN. His new book is called The Rise and Fall of Osama bin Laden. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. This was an excerpt of their interview. To hear the full interview, check out our show from August 4th on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. I'm Terry Gross.